When Marian Mason was graduate dean at the University of California, Berkeley, one of the most frequent questions that she heard from women graduate students was, when is a good time to have a baby? Now, for women in academic science careers, the conventional answer to that question was, when you've achieved tenure. In 1985, the national average age of scientists winning tenure was 36 years old. But by 2003, that average age had crept up to 39. So, as Mason points out, it's increasingly poor advice to tell people to wait until they have achieved tenure to start to build a family. Now, Mason believes that women researchers should be able to have children whenever they want, and that's one of the key arguments of a new report that she has co-authored that looks at data taken from extensive surveys of graduate students and postdoctoral researchers within the University of California system. And it shows that work-life issues, and particularly decisions about when to get married and when to have children, actually account for the most significant loss of women academic scientists in the pipeline, moving between getting their PhD and winning tenure track positions. Now, to discuss the report and to discuss the kinds of policies that federal granting agencies and that research universities can implement to be more family-friendly and to let people have more flexibility and stay in this research pipeline, we have joining us today two of the authors of this new report, Marian Mason, who's professor and co-faculty director of the Berkeley Law Center on Health, Economic, and Family Security, and Mark Golden, who is director of data initiatives and academic affairs at the University of California, Berkeley. As well joining us is Robert Berdahl, who is president of the Association of American Universities. I'm Andrew Clemens Pratt, managing editor of Science Progress. Thank you all, everyone, for joining us today, Marianne, Mark, and Bob. What I wanted to start with is this question about the basic proportion of women who are at the top of the scientific research establishment in the United States. And the report that we're talking about today makes the argument that this is really an issue of national competitiveness. And I'm curious to hear people explain why that is, when in fact there's pretty good data indicating that we're producing more and more PhDs in science and engineering in this country each year.
Yes, I'll take that. We are producing more and more, and of course we have more and more demand for it because it's a large expanding industry. But the trends are really against us because more and more of those students have always been international students, and increasingly other countries, particularly China and Korea and the European countries, have really strengthened their own PhD program and their own sciences, have become very prestigious in their own way. When I was in China as the graduate dean for Berkeley in 2005, they had actually doubled their PhD population in 5 years, and were planning on doing that again. And they give pretty big incentives for Chinese students who study here to come back home, similarly with Korea. So the days of having basically the advantage of the brain gain from our side are really waning. And there have been efforts over the last 20, 30 years to develop our domestic pool of scientists. And women have really done this. They have gone in and doubled and tripled their numbers in most fields. And in the biological sciences, they're now 50%. So they've really stepped up to the plate. But what we've seen is that they don't stay there. They leak out, usually after getting a PhD or a postdoc. And our research shows that the leak is almost entirely, or certainly primarily, due to family formation, childbirth, or marriage, but particularly childbirth.
Well, Mary, you make a good point there, and maybe Bob, you could speak to this. The percentage of women who are at the undergraduate level on a science or engineering track is very large, and in fact, in a lot of areas, as you were saying, exceeds the proportion of men in the field. Is that correct?
Yes, it is at the undergraduate level. I think that's really increasingly the case.
But things are changing so that people don't stay in the pipeline after they finish those undergraduate degrees, correct?
That's true. And I think Marianne's study has pointed to quite a number of the reasons why the pipeline is leaking with regard to women continuing on through PhDs or through postdocs into research careers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the concern is that we have a process in which a large number of very talented scientists are not getting the kind of encouragement or are being discouraged, in not necessarily intentionally, but are discouraged, let me put it that way, about a career in science because of some of the demands that it puts upon them.
Well, Can we talk for just a minute about some of the what those discouraging factors are? The report goes into to some detail to talk about the reasons that people who are moving up through the academic ladder list, and there's fairly detailed survey data on this. What are the things that people are citing as the reasons for dropping out of these careers as they move from PhD programs to postdocs into tenure track faculty positions?
Well, it really starts at an early level, certainly by the graduate student years. We surveyed all the graduate students, all the doctoral students in the UC system, about 8,000 of them. And already, for both men and women, the university has an unfriendly family feel about it. And they select it as being the least family-friendly of all the possible careers, including a teaching career or a career in government, et cetera. And they look around and they see, particularly the women, they see very few women in their departments who have children, because the scientists who are currently in positions of full professorships, et cetera, are far less likely to have children than the men are. And they think they don't necessarily want their life that way. They find it too difficult. And those who do have children, as either graduate students or postdocs, mostly will leave the pipeline because many reasons. They're not supported. Their mentors are not necessarily supportive of it. And for many, there really is no support in terms of just childbirth paid leave or any kind of campus support. The culture is not ready for it. I will say that we've really gone a long way at Berkeley and UC to change that, and Bob Berdahl was very instrumental because when I was graduate dean, he was very helpful, as were a number of other chancellors and the president of the university, in really trying to transform the system and make the culture more family-friendly. And we are seeing some benefits from it today. So there is hope. It just is done in a very uneven way. Some of the AU universities have very good plans in place and are very conscious. Others have nothing. And the agencies also, they would like women to stay in. They're very encouraged and encouraging to women to stay in, but they don't exactly know what to do, or the university's policies are in their way, and by law, it's the university that has to determine the personnel policy. So some of the agencies, like NIH, has a number of initiatives. Others have nothing at all. So there's a huge variation on the scene of what universities and what granting agencies provide, or how they even see this as an issue. And I think our effort here is to try to get them to recognize it as a real issue and suggest some ways they can actually work on it positively.
Well, Mark, you work in academic affairs there at UC Berkeley. What are some of the things that the university has done to make these decisions easier for women to stay in those tenure-track positions?
Well, my focus there is primarily on faculty issues, and in the last 10 years or so, we've promoted a number of excellent family-friendly policies, including tenure clock extension at the time of a birth event, what's called active service modified duties, which provides teaching relief for faculty at the time of the birth event. We've even gone so far as to look at flexible part-time options for faculty, which is the tradition has largely been full-time positions. So we're looking at ways to try to encourage slowdowns, temporary slowdowns, and at the time of acute caregiving responsibilities. In terms of doctoral students and graduate students, certainly Marianne could speak to those.
Yes, but for the graduate students, we instituted paid family leave, and there's also a graduate student parent bonus, which is means tested. Just give them some extra money to help with childcare or whatever they need, or sometimes rent. We have family housing. We have subsidized childcare. We've tried to put a lot of things in place which will make graduate students feel that the university is a friendly place and that women are encouraged to go on and have families. Men, too, because for men this is an important issue. One of the things that was most gratifying, we changed the for faculty, we also allowed fathers who had substantial responsibilities to take a semester off of teaching. And in the beginning, people said, oh, men won't do that, but we wanted to have fathers involved with it, and women wouldn't do it if men didn't do it because they were afraid they would lose the competitive game, basically.
Interesting.
And I'm finding here in the law school that the young fathers are routinely doing it and thinking of it, as one does after a while, as an entitlement, as something that they should do. It's not just something odd and unusual. So changing the culture in that way over a period of time, I think, does create a very different atmosphere.
That's a really interesting point, that this isn't just about changing behaviors for women, but it's also about men rethinking their place in the process.
Yes.
I wonder if any of you have any experience with individual students or cohorts of students that you've talked to where you've really noticed a change in the way they're making decisions about whether or not to stay in science over the long term.
Well, of course, I've talked to any number of graduate students over the year. And in science, there's some really good science, because if women in science at the graduate student and undergraduate level form their own societies, they encourage each other. They encourage each other to stay in the field. They encourage each other to think about having families. And then they bring in people like me to help them be coaches. But I think this in some ways is the best way, as well as mentors. The American Physical Society has a great program for undergraduates. We're at undergraduate women. And every year they have three different host campuses, and they have these large conferences where women scientists come in and talk about both the wonderful things they do, but also how they make it work. And this has been enormously important for these young women, particularly when they're in fields where they might not have, at some of these small colleges, any women physicists on the faculty. Hmm. There are any number of good ways in which people will help each other, and I do see it happening certainly in the Berkeley campus over these years.
That's great to hear. Maybe, Dr. Bardal, you could speak to this question. Is this an issue that's primarily the responsibility of research universities, or does the responsibility fall on the federal granting agencies when we're talking about people in the sciences?
Well, I think it's heavily an issue of universities, because I think the university policies ultimately shape the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And getting these kinds of policies in place so that there are opportunities for women that are family-friendly is really changes the attitudes and the culture, I think, at the ground level. So I see really the first order of responsibility being a university responsibility to create a culture that understands why this is important and why we need to make these kinds of changes. Beyond that, I believe that there probably are in some of the granting agencies also, particularly with regard to graduate students and postdocs. I think we're addressing, or more universities are addressing, the issue when it comes to faculty, but we're slower in addressing it at the graduate and postdoc student level. And so I think there are some policies that federal agencies could encourage that would allow paid leaves and things of that type. I think it ultimately comes back to a cultural issue with attitudes that need to be really brought around to a different mode, because faculty who have graduate students or who have postdocs, I think, have to recognize, I mean, they're in very competitive positions. They need the work of postdocs and graduate students in their laboratories, and they depend upon that. So changing the culture so that you do, create an atmosphere where it's okay for a woman graduate student to decide to have a baby while she's in school. And bear in mind that that period from the mid-20s to the mid-30s is really the time when the opportunities for having children are really the most crucial. And so it seems to me that getting those attitudinal changes and the cultural changes in institutions will ultimately lead to changes in federal policy.
No, I think that's an important point to make, because as the report discusses, the situation is such that for a lot of principal investigators leading research projects, there's an incentive to a certain degree to make somewhat unfair hiring decisions. Is that the case?
Well, I'm not sure if we know that they're making unfair hiring decisions, but mm-hmm. they're definitely caught between a rock and a hard place on this issue.
Right.
Because if they're researchers have children and go and leave, that results in a loss of productivity to their grant. And as it stands, for the most part, they receive no additional supplemental funding in that situation. So what happens when they go back up to reapply for another grant or when they're pursuing other venues for funding, that can hurt them. So right now, even though I think the vast majority of PIs want to do the right thing, they want to benefit the researchers working on their grants, there's a point of tension there. And that's where I think universities and federal agencies can step in and help them with that.
No, that's understandable. It's and a lot of this research is in very competitive fields.
Oh, yeah.
Very competitive.
And we're also talking about another issue that the report raises, which is there seems to be a spectrum between graduate students who are working in labs to trainees that are moving up the ladder to full-fledged workers who are considered employees of the university. Is there an issue with that gray area about who is a student and who is a trainee with regard to the labor policies here?
Well, in general, nationally, graduate student researchers and postdoctoral fellows are typically considered trainees. Soft money academic researchers and faculty are considered employees. But what I would say in general is if you're looking at individuals such as graduate students, postdoctoral fellows, many of them are in their early 30s. And this, as Bob mentioned, this is a time that they may want to be having children. But if they're under-benefited at this time, and our evidence suggests that these are the populations that are most under-benefited in terms of family-responsive policies, this can send a message to them that science and fast-track careers in academia are not family-friendly. So what I would argue is that investing in these policies at this critical time is really a good long-term investment.
One of the other points that the report makes is that not only is this a good investment, but we actually lose a public investment when people drop out of the research pipeline like this. Can you all speak to that issue and about what we're losing in terms of public good and public investment when people decide to leave these kinds of careers?
Well, we're losing a lot just in terms of dollars and cents. Generally, on the average, a graduate student support is perhaps $50,000 to $60,000 a year, depending on the tuition of the university. And the postdocs similarly are $50,000 to $60,000. So if you're talking about training a young scientist from the beginning of their graduate days through a postdoc, you put in probably just in dollars and cents close to $500,000 or perhaps even more. So there's a big economic issue there. But in terms of women particularly who are dropping out, if they don't continue in the pipeline, then those behind them will also drop out. The phenomenon recapitulates itself because young women coming up don't see that it's possible for the older women, and therefore they also become part of that cycle. So it's, in many ways, it's an investment not just in the dollars and cents, but in the future population coming through as well.
No, that seems like a tragic sort of loss. Let me ask about Title IX here. We've talked a little bit about some effective policies that grant-making agencies and that universities are implementing or are experimenting with. Does the lack of effective policies like that raise Title IX violation questions?
Well, Title IX, of course, is a very general law, and it generally applies to gender discrimination in all academic programs of any kind. And it's been used mostly, I think we have to say, in terms of women's sports. But I think people don't realize that part of Title IX, the regs that are attached to it, also includes maternal discrimination, pregnancy discrimination, and the requirement that the employer have some form of published policy for a leave with the right of return, maternity leave for the right of return. And as Bob was saying, many of our universities, particularly for the graduate and postdoc level, have virtually no policies relating to family or childbirth for the graduate students and postdocs. So there are technically possibly several violations or many violations of Title IX by many universities. Here's where the agencies do come in, because they do believe in compliance, and they are the Title IX compliance reporting agencies. But I think when they do, in fact, I know, when they do the Title IX investigations, and there have been some recently in science, they don't necessarily adequately look at those issues. It doesn't seem to be part of the full scope. So we need to have a lot more information, and the agencies are really capable of doing that with the Title IX-I. Title IX also can be used more broadly from even a young age, grade school, et cetera, to get women more integrated into science, and this is what Obama and others have said. But specifically in terms of the childbirth issue, there is a technical requirement, both of no discrimination against pregnancy and to provide some form of childbirth leave, unpaid, doesn't have to be paid, with the right of return. These young people are not covered for the most part by the Family Medical Leave Act because they are not technically employees or they just don't follow into the category of the Family Medical Leave Act. So they have no protection.
I would simply say I do think that it is more difficult to apply Title IX to graduate student decisions and postdoc decisions about careers and so forth than it is, say, in intercollegiate athletics where, you know, most of the Title IX attention is focused, where it really is talking more about proportionate opportunities with sports and things of that type. So much of the kind of decision-making that women engage in about their careers, I think, is the sense that, wow, pursuing a research career as a research scientist at a university requires such an enormous commitment of time to be successful that it would be difficult for me to do that and have a family at the same time. That has to do with the whole balance of responsibilities between husbands and wives. It has to do with you know, a number of very, very subtle kinds of things that go into these decisions. Clearly, we need policies that will not penalize women for making those decisions. At the same time, it seems to me, Title IX becomes, aside from the kinds of things that Marianne has pointed to, it becomes a fairly crude instrument for measuring the success or failure of universities in terms of faculty and graduate student postdoc decision-making.
Is outright discrimination or sort of old guard sexist notions of women operating in these particular fields, does that have any real substance as a caveat about these numbers, or is that a red herring that comes up in these conversations sometimes?
Well, that's an interesting question. When you think of gender discrimination, you think of it more often the Larry Summers variety of women aren't competent enough. And that occurs as well, I'm sure. It's just much more difficult to really pin it down. The way in which we see it is you can explain most of women's decisions on not necessarily that, but just on the, as Bob pointed out, the difficulty of combining family with career. And it seems more fruitful to really focus on that particular issue. It doesn't mean that other things aren't fruitful as well, and I'm sure there is some gender discrimination that's not of the maternal discrimination variety. And when I say maternal discrimination, which is probably not such a good word for it, it's more like what Mark was saying, that there's a little bit of a disincentive for PIs, investigators, to hire women if they're going to get pregnant or if they are pregnant, et cetera, largely because of the economic loss and productivity loss, and that could be addressed differently. That's not even so much gender discrimination. It's really sort of an economic issue. That's easier to get at. There probably always will be other kinds of discrimination. One can't know for sure, but this one we can definitely focus on.
I think that the kind of overt discrimination that I have to say I certainly witnessed early in my career toward women in academic roles and their faculty hiring and those kinds of. I think that there probably is still some of that exists, but I think most of that has gone. I mean, and the discrimination that I think women face now with regard to family commitments is a much more subtle kind of thing. It's a question of, am I going to be taken as seriously as a scholar or a scientist if I have a family? And the fear that you're not, because obviously you have committed yourself to another set of obligations, or you're not spending all of your time in the laboratory, or you have distractions that may interfere with your total commitment to your profession. I think those are the kinds of subtle discriminations that really are discouraging to women. Not so much, although I know it still exists in some place, not so much the overt discrimination. I don't know, Marianne, is that...
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And it really has much more to do with the time issue than the mental competence issue, which was kind of the old-fashioned.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of evidence that academics who are generally very achievement-minded, that they make a lot of decisions based on fears that if they do something, it will hurt their career. A good example that we see now is, I think, the threshold it used to be for women in academia. The idea of having children was maybe perceived as just a bad idea. We might now be at a threshold where having one child is considered a reasonably okay idea, but having two or three, that sounds like too much from a career perspective. And then we've had a lot of experience with some great family-friendly policies within the UC system, but sometimes academics will not take them because they're afraid that it will either make them look as though they're not serious academics or that they're not fully committed to their careers.
I'm wondering, on a policy level, since we are talking about a report that's taking a hard look at the issue and is recommending some ways to rectify these numbers, what are the next steps? Does it need to happen within big university systems like the UC system, where they need to get together, share policies, and then implement them? Does it need to happen sort of at the level of these larger organizations like the AAU, or does it need to come from the federal direction with the granting agencies?
Well, in my opinion, the AAU is really the organization that could best coordinate it, since it is representing the major research universities. We've done a lot of this in the UC system itself, getting together, and it's really helped. It's changed a lot. The agencies, I think, would like to be involved with it as well. Everyone is very concerned about it. It's not like people wouldn't like to change it, but there's been not a whole lot of coordination or focus. We have suggested some baseline responsive policies that could be agreed upon by both the universities and the agencies would, you know, provide some of the funding for it. We're putting a lot of funding into science these days with the new stimulus plan, and perhaps this could be part of what goes on there. But so far, the efforts have been a little bit piecemeal in terms of how universities do it, and certainly among the agencies as well. They don't have any coordinated look at it. But coordinating all these efforts, I think, would be a really good step.
I was just going to say, I think that the role of the AAU, we're not a system like UC, so that we can't adopt policies that would apply to our institutions in the way that say the UC system can do that. But what we can do is really try to educate our administrators and our faculty about the issues that are raised by reports like this, so that Marianne was reporting to the graduate deans, for example, on the findings of her study. I think that is the role of trying to bring to our key administrators the facts about the leaky pipeline and successful policies that some institutions are adopting to address it.
Well, I wanted to ask, and maybe each of you might have a different perspective on this, but if you were speaking with a woman who was about to enter into, say, a PhD program in the life sciences and was thinking down the road that she did want to start a family, what might you say at this particular juncture to someone considering that sort of career leap based on the current status of these policies?
When I was graduate dean, that was the question I most often got from women graduate students. when is a good time to have a baby? and the perceived wisdom used to be wait until you get tenure, but that goal is actually receding. It's now 39 is the average age at getting tenure. It used to be 36. So it's increasingly poor advice to wait until you get to tenure. I think women should be able to have children whenever they are ready to. And I think our system, UC system, and many universities across the country are trying to move toward this, to provide a culture that allows it at any time. The problem with science in general, it doesn't necessarily get better as you get older. It will always be difficult, and the hours will always be long. But if there's a shared culture in which you make it possible and you're supportive of each other, it should actually start at the graduate student level. We actually had a little burstlet, I have to say, here at the UC campus of graduate students having children. It's not just because they have better support systems. We just try to encourage the culture to encourage it and not be as discouraging as it has been in the past.
I would say that I think, obviously, the issues that are addressed or that need to be addressed with regard to the sciences are a little bit different than they are in some of the other disciplines. And it does vary by discipline. I have two daughters who became academics, neither of them natural scientists, but one became an anthropologist. Well, that's a field in which women faculty are very, very prevalent. And she had a child, her first child, when she was in graduate school, and it did not, I think, in any way affect her. She was not viewed askance. My other daughter teaches in a business school, and I think that there, where it's a much more male-dominant culture, the sense of, and she had a child while she was still a non-tenured faculty, the sense of putting yourself at risk by early childbearing is probably greater. So it does differ, I think, by field to some extent.
And it does by the percentage of women in the field, too.
Right.
No, that.
And so if we get more women in these fields,
yes,
that's
right.
How the culture will change.
It will help. It will certainly help.
Yeah, I one point, one recommendation I would have is I would suggest to graduate students that they look at a range of different career options and really assess them. When we surveyed doctoral students and postdoctoral students throughout the UC system, they see research-intensive universities as the least family-friendly, whereas they see teaching-intensive colleges and universities as more family-friendly, and careers outside academia is more family-friendly. And some of this may be true to some extent, but I think research universities are now really moving on these issues. And it probably started with a focus on faculty, but they're pushing down now into the postdoctoral and graduate student ranks. So I hope that they don't give up entirely on careers at research universities, because we definitely want to keep them in the pipeline, and we hope they keep moving in the direction towards the faculty position.
Don't you think that difference between teaching intensive in institutions being more family friendly than research intensive institutions? It, probably men would say the same thing. Male graduate students would.
Yeah,
I mean,
they do.
That wouldn't be limited just to women.
No.
No, but you know, it's interesting because we've actually not investigated that closely, but I've had any number of faculty members from teaching colleges who would tell me how difficult it was because they either have no policies, they can't get such small departments,
right.
They can't afford to let you go for mm-hmm. a semester. So they don't necessarily have better support. There's a perception that they do, but
yeah,
in reality
right.
that...
That's a good point.
I think it's important that everyone, as Bob said, look at their culture, and it's not just the rules you have on the books, but it's how everyone on campus is educated. We have two ways of doing it here. We have a toolkit for deans and chairs, and every year when old chairs, too, because they rotate pretty quickly, we have a session on orientation on what the family-friendly policies are and what are the consequences and what are the good things you can do, sort of re-indoctrination every year. And then we also give something out to the graduate students and faculty about what family-friendly policies are for them so they can really push for them. That's a cultural change, but you have to have it based on some real change underneath as well.
Well, thank you all very much for joining me for this conversation. Mark Golden is the Director of Data Initiatives and Academic Affairs at the University of California, Berkeley. Bob Rudall is the President of the Association of American Universities. And Marianne Mason is Professor and Co-Faculty Director of the Berkeley Law Center on Health, Economic, and Family Security at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. Me too.